Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is Friday. It's true crime time and kind of a special true crime time. This is an update, and I'm not sure that that Jen and I have actually ever had an update before, but I have Jen with me. Jen, how are you?
Hi, it's Friday, so I'm doing very good. Got my color-changing cup, and I'm ready to go. How are you?
Nice. Color-changing cup. I like that. I have seen color-changing spoons. I'm good. You know, this one, the first time that Jen and I ever recorded, we did two episodes at once. And this was the second episode that we did. This would be episode 9 overall on the podcast. And I don't recall what episode 8 is. I did not scroll through to figure out what it was. I need to. But this is episode 9 on the whole podcast. And we talked about Elisa Lam. And when we did it the first time, we 95% of it just focused on the actual crime and who did it and all of this kind of stuff. And we didn't actually – we touched – briefly on some of the conspiracy stuff around it. But we didn't really go into deep on that. And since you and I've done that episode, which was back in, I think, September of 2018, a lot's changed. A lot more people are talking about some of the conspiracies. A lot more people are talking about new information that's come out. And I think it's a great time to kind of revisit Elisa.
Yeah, it's also eerily interesting that if we can't not revisit it, because I saw that a lot of the interessants had asked questions. And as I started looking into it, I'm like, I've got to ask Enzi, what does he think now that it's 2020? Because when we were talking about, you know, human stealth camo suits and stuff like that, it's like, could that stuff really be real? So, you know, it's like, let's just get into some of these conspiracy theories. And I just want to see what you think.
Remind everybody, if they don't know about Elisa Lam, just kind of, you know, the gist of her death and how she was found and stuff.
Yes, she was a 21-year-old Chinese-Canadian student that was visiting the Los Angeles area, and she just happened to pick the seedy downtown area Cecil Hotel, and that hotel has a whole wicked history all by itself. But so she was 21. She was the girl that was found floating in the water tank on top of the hotel roof. So that's kind of what she's sadly famous for.
Yeah, you know, it was eerily reminiscent of Dark Water, the movie. And, of course, American Horror Story was inspired by a season of it was inspired by it. There's just a lot of stuff. It's a remarkable case. And as people have dug into it, I think that the reason people have been so interested in the case, not only because it was so eerily similar in a way to Dark Water, but the fact that we had video of Elisa Lam, right? And it was so paranormal activity-ish that it keeps people coming back for more.
Yeah, when you look at the video, I realize that, you know, the timestamp's been blurred. It's also been slowed down. I try to figure out, did they want her to appear to be crazy, or was she legit crazy? I mean, I know that she had some medical issues and she struggled with mental health and things like that. But when you look at the video, it's like, okay, where was her glasses? And was she playing with someone? Was there someone that's in that hallway? Because you hear all of this like conspiracy gossip about a second tape that LAPD never released that does exist because they didn't think it was pertinent to the case.
My questions on the video, and I have to be honest, is when we did this back in 2018, I had seen the stills from the video, and I think that I saw a shortened, you know, because there's a lot of different clips online. I think I saw a 15-second clip or something like that. But this time around, I went and I watched, you know, the entire thing of it. And it is obviously creepy. But, you know, a lot of things are a little creepy. If you have a security camera in your house or something like that and just focus it on you with no audio at all in some kind of black and white, thing, and it'll look grainy. It'll look creepy, you know, so you kind of have to take that a little bit. But one of the things that I've never really understood, because of the timestamp, right? You know, it has been blurred over, and I'm not exactly, you know, sure why, but somebody, you know, they've tried to analyze the timestamp really, really closely. And that's how they realized that, you know, the tape had been edited. Now, it was done subtly, you know, that's part of the thing. It's just, you know, why would you do it kind of subtly like that? But then also it was cut at specific points. And everybody speculates, well, you know, it was cut because there were people in it that weren't, you know, part of the case, or they just happened to wander by. But that doesn't make a lot of sense to me, because first of all, it's been years now, so go ahead and release the original. Second of all, those people could have needed to be interviewed, maybe would provide context to people.
Yeah, because the thing is, they say there's no witnesses to her actual behavior outside of the CCTV footage. So if there was people they're cutting out for privacy reasons, where are those witnesses? Because to hear LAPD say it, there aren't any. No one witnessed her playing in the elevator. You know, she would have been holding the elevator up so that other guests couldn't get on it anyways.
And you know, and then, like you said, if you look at a very close eye on the timer, you can see that parts have been slowed down. And, you know, but did these slowdowns make it seem as if she was more strange? Was it done to make us feel a certain way about her and her actions? You know,
and see, I kind of go with that, because they really dehumanized her. A lot of the good traits that she had that would have made her very warm to the public, had the media, you know, talked about her and talked about those things, you know, I think they would have treated it, the case, differently. They made it come across as she's bipolar. She is very vulnerable. When you speed the tape up, to me, it's just my opinion, she does not look that crazy. It looks crazier once it's slowed down. And then, of course, like you said, edited and then spliced.
And, you know, again, I think I brought this up the first time around, is that the video was given to the LAPD by hotel management. And apparently, you know, was it LAPD who never thought to question the issue with the timestamp? Was it the hotel owners that were hiding something? And my number one, and I encourage everybody to go watch it, and the first thing that you will notice, besides, just ignore Elisa in the video for a second, and the first thing that you will notice is those doors never close in 4 minutes. And it's not as if she walks away from the door several times, and it never closes. And I find that to be crazy. And because so it's not like she stuck a hand in the door to keep it open or something.
Or
and it opened.
Was there someone there? The whole thing where she was looking into the cloaking capabilities, and she was talking possibly to a soldier online. And then you look and see the people that have dredged up about the Invisible Lie Agency and the fact that they were a defense contracting shell. Were they into these invisibility cloaks? Because the main thing about the whole cloaking thing is that you're fighting an invisible enemy. You never know where they are. So in one part of the video, it kind of looks like that she is knocked or touched by something. And then she's feeling, you know, like the hollow air to see where something is. That's always bothered me. I'm like, what is she reaching for?
No,
like, was
I
it
agree.
In her head, or was there someone really there that we couldn't see?
Because she definitely has that. It's almost as if she's a blind person, which she may have been because she didn't have her glasses on, right?
Yeah. Where did her glasses go?
Where she's reaching out and, okay, I'm trying to see if something is there. And where's that wall? Like, close your eyes and walk, and you're holding out your hand, you know, knowing that you're going to run into the wall, but you're not exactly sure when. And it kind of gives that sense to it for sure. And the fact that they don't close. And so then it made me think, as we're talking right now, it made me think that it could be somebody right outside the elevator door who's holding, say, the down button or the up button. So that way it stays open, you know, and because you can't see that. Now, I have heard, and I am not sure, but I have heard this, that there was a camera in the hallway too, but we never really see that.
Yeah, that's going to be that second tape that LAPD has. They've admitted it, that it exists, but they said it wasn't pertinent to the case. I'm like, how is it not important? Because it shows the hallway, and wouldn't we need another view of her? And second, why would you not want to show if someone's there or not? You know, what are they hiding?
And so that's one of the things. And then supposedly there was a lobby camera that we've never seen either. The problem with all of this, and if you try and go now, is that the hotel has been closed for a while because it's undergoing renovations. And, you know, so people can't get in there to see, okay, is there a camera in the thing? Now, I know that there was reporters who stayed at the Cecil right after her body was discovered just to kind of get a look. But when I read those articles, they're talking about the creepiness of the Cecil, or Stay on Main, I think it was actually called at that point. But they don't ever talk about, okay, well, here's where the cameras are. Here's these kind of things. So we're just going by, you know, stuff that's posted, but nobody's ever come out and said, okay, yes, here's the cameras. Here's right this. You know, there's a camera in the lobby, because these things are important as we discuss certain theories and conspiracy theories about this case, because there's stuff that happened in the lobby. Okay, great. If this stuff happened, let's see the videos for that. And obviously they kept their tapes for a certain amount of time, because they didn't hand this over until 3 days or something. Cause the LAPD was like, where is this person? So let's do, you know, this video and let's show it to everybody, you know, and that was 3 or 4 days after the fact. So obviously they had, you know, a lengthy holding process for their things.
That's another conspiracy. Why was there such a lengthy holding process, and why did they take so long to find her body? When you talk about a person going missing on the 1st of that February, and you have LAPD coming in with dogs and things like that, and they don't find a girl whose corpse is rotting in the water tower. I mean, where was she all that time? Was she really in the water tower? Did they actually look for her, or did they look the other direction? And the reason I ask is because the conspiracy theory linked to finance. The hotel was in agreements to be into a partnership or to be sold. The owner was facing either foreclosure or a very, very low income, because he had all these ideas to bring the hotel, you know, up to code, make it nicer, pull in a trendier crowd. And the city was like, whoa, whoa. You know, we're going to hang you up in red tape because you're going to ruin the nostalgia if you start redoing the hotel. And plus, we have to have so many Section 8s in downtown Los Angeles, and you'll push the drug dealers and homeless and all that towards areas we don't want them. So they hung the owner up. So he goes to sell to that company. And I think I sent you some
yeah,
notes.
Yeah, you know,
to
they ended up selling it to – it dropped out from that first owner. So it finally did sell in 2014. To New York real estate developer Richard Bourne. And Richard Bourne is kind of an interesting guy. He owns a lot of properties, and he owns properties including like the Bowery, the Maritime, the Ludlow, and the Greenwich. He's done business with a bunch of different people that are, you know, always popping up. He was a surgeon originally, which I found kind of interesting. And he has done deals with, get these names. So he's partnered with Robert De Niro and Raphael on the Greenwich. He also joined forces with Andre Ballas, who is, of course, Mr. Epstein's good friend. And, you know, also worked with Ian Schrager and some others on New York properties. And one of the things, like you mentioned, you know, part of the deal is, you know, they need to have some low income housing in this thing, but it's not going to maybe even open until the end of 2021. But the owners were, you know, kind of in trouble, and this kind of pushed them over the edge a little bit. One of the things that I wanted to talk to you about, and this is straight up crazy kind of thing, but we're going to talk about it, is let's talk about the elevator game. And so when Elisa goes into the elevator, she is pressing buttons, and she presses them in a certain order, and people have decided what the order is that she presses them. But there was a game going on at the time of her death. And it was, the thing is that kind of, it was a Korean game, kind of a Bloody Mary type game. And obviously she was Chinese and not Korean. However, you know, there's a large Asian community in Vancouver where she was from. So she probably knew about the thing. But essentially the idea is that you select a certain sequence of floor buttons on an elevator, and that the person playing the game can be transported to some kind of, you know, alternate dimension, which looks the same as the town or the building that you're from, but all the lights are off and you can only see a red cross in the distance. And the trip is dangerous, and the players are often disoriented upon returning to their home dimension. And so this disorientation or whatever explains why Elisa's strange behavior and, you know, her physical kind of wobbliness and her eventual decision to, quote unquote, jump into the water tank.
I looked at the elevator game in the beginning. I was convinced that that was what had happened to her and that she had played that because you needed the building. The rules are with at least 10 floors. So yep. She had picked the Cecil for some reason. And then she gets off the elevator and she's like reaching for the hollow air. And you wonder, what is she reaching for? And they talk about an elevator game, how this woman will show up. And that's how you know that you've reached the right dimension. And I'm like, is she reaching for the lady?
Yeah, because so the rules are, if anybody's never heard of it, so it's a 10-story building, like Jen said. You have to be in the elevator alone. If someone's in the elevator with you, it won't work. You get on the elevator on the first floor, though. And then you press 4. And when you reach the fourth floor, you don't get out. And you press 2. When you reach the second floor, you press 6. When you reach the sixth floor, you press 2. When you reach the second floor, press 10. When you reach the 10th floor, press 5. And then when you reach the fifth floor, a girl will come in. And that woman's not human. You don't talk to her or look at the girl. If you do, she'll take you away. And then you press 1. And if the elevator instead starts going up to the 10th floor, then you've succeeded. You will have reached another world where there is no one except you. If you get off at the 10th floor, the girl will ask, where are you going? But you don't answer. And to return, if the woman doesn't get on, and if you don't get off at the 10th floor, if you don't get off at the 10th floor, then press 1. If it doesn't press, keep on pressing until it works.
I'm surprised that if she was playing that game, she didn't have a sheet to tell her what to do. I mean, did she memorize how to play that, if that's what she's doing?
You know, and the other thing, she didn't have her glasses on.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. You know, she goes on to lose too many items for me to think that the elevator game is considerable now. I mean, her glasses go missing, her laptop, her phone was never recovered. Things that make you highly vulnerable. You know, so who set her up for that kind of failure? I look at that.
And I'm trying to see. Everybody agrees here. This is the consensus, is that she pressed the buttons 14, then 10, then 7, then 4, then B, and then block hold. That is kind of what everybody has kind of agreed on. So it doesn't really work in the nature of the game.
No, not at all.
So, you know, that kind of takes apart the whole elevator game, because, or she just, again, maybe she never glasses, but I mean, that's not in any way, shape or form the order it's supposed to go. So
we pretty much rule that out. And yeah, I know that on one of her social media accounts, she had something that kind of aligns to the elevator game. She'd taken a picture of some type of a sign that was at an art museum she was visiting, and it talks about all these floors and stuff that kind of match up to this elevator game situation. But I tend to rule it out at this point.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, here's something that kind of freaks me out a little bit. Okay, so, and to kind of play devil's advocate on that she might still be in a different world.
Well, she was very into, none of the stuff is out of the possibilities of being exciting to Elisa Lam, because if you read any of her social medias, and she had quite a few, she uses multiple pen names. She likes the whole Second Life type situation. So when you talk about other worlds and things that are crazy, you know, aliens, cloaking, and all that kind of stuff, you know, I feel like she'd be into it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that everybody thinks that maybe she's not dead is because after she was supposedly dead, her blog made a few posts after her death.
Right, but her family said that it was possibly set to auto-post while she was traveling.
Correct. And, you know, obviously, I mean, even me on the site, I can set posts for whenever I want to set them. I could set one for a week from now. Now, I don't ever do that. The most I do is set them for, you know, later in the day. But it's certainly possible that she could have. And the thing is, she didn't generally write. She just posted a lot of photos for the most part. So there's no text or anything. And after her death, there's no text posted, just images. But the problem is that even before her death, most of the stuff was just, you know, reposted images too.
On her Twitter, she tended to retweet a lot, but on her Tumblr, she'd get a little bit more personal. The thing that I thought was weird was when she reached Los Angeles, she had posted, you know, I've arrived to La La Land. And then I looked at her hashtags and one of them was interwar. And see, that sent me back to the whole, was she playing the cloaking game? Like, what did this girl think that she was getting into? You know, if you start getting in bed with people that are contractors, soldiers, and in defense and things like that, you're likely going to lose. Because as far as I'm concerned, she was not in military or anything like that. She was just a girl. And she technically wasn't even a student because she had completed.
She wasn't registered, right?
No, she had unregistered herself, been out for a while, and she only completed 3 classes within 3 years.
I have something creepy for you, and this is courtesy of Mask Sign blog spot.com, and they have written on Elisa Lam, and one of the things that they talked about when they were talking about whether or not she was still alive, and this actually happened 5 days ago, and it's kind of an update to what they had written. And it says, an update from June 2020. The Mask Sign recently received a ping back from Elisa's blog. And the author says, my wife, who knows more about this kind of thing than I do, assures me that this is a normal thing to happen. For some non-supernatural reason I don't fully understand, I admit, however, that it did considerably freak me out. And I think that it would freak me out, too. And I'm not sure why this website that has written about Elisa's blog and her case is getting a ping back from the blog at this point in June of 2020.
That is creepy because the thing is, like, her Tumblr, it kept going. So there was this automated post, but her Twitter came to a halt. The last thing that she had posted on her Twitter was the word speakeasy, which is, you know, it's a term for blind. It can also it could stand for bar, but it's more like private, secret, squirrel, you know, let's not get caught kind of thing. So, I mean, who is she meeting at a speakeasy?
Yeah. Let's talk about one of the most common conspiracy on this whole thing is Elisa Lam and Lam Elisa. I think that this is the most popular you know, that everybody can kind of get behind because everybody's, that is the strangest coincidence in the history of the world. That Elisa Lam, obviously is the person that was killed or died, however you want to do it. And Lam Elisa is a test for tuberculosis. And at that time in this depressed part of Los Angeles with the homeless population, they had a huge tuberculosis outbreak.
Well, of course. You have a girl found in a water tower, and then suddenly, boom, there's a TB outbreak with the same name that the girl has. So you go to search for her death, right, because you're curious. And what happens? You're clouded by all these test results and things to do with the Los Angeles outbreak.
Yeah. And, I mean, there were a lot of people. This was not a small outbreak at all. And, you know, you can really, really get into and go deep when you start to get to that part. Because then, you know, okay, who makes the tests and all of this kind of stuff. But people thought, okay, that her death was part of an elaborate cover-up, you know, regarding the tuberculosis outbreak, which was apparently caused by the government for some unknown reason. And
Well, yeah, you have a body that is rotting in a water tower for 3 weeks, and you have the residents that are drinking that water and bathing in it. And there was a couple of reports that came early on for maintenance to check out that problem, and it went reportedly ignored. And then they didn't correct it until they actually found her body. So all that is suspicious. I mean, did any of those people ever come down with TB? Did they get sick? We'll never know because they probably signed NDAs.
And one of the things that I wanted to look at is, so when you start talking about it, I believe that, okay, here we go. Because I wanted to get it right. I don't want to say it wrong or anything like that. So the Tuberculosis Research Center in Canada is at the University of British Columbia, which is where Elisa attended school when she did go to school. So, you know, so people pull that out. And, you know, also there was the talk that the CIA, and I think you and I touched on it in the first episode, is that the CIA used, you know, the Hotel Cecil, and that, you know, perhaps they were running some kind of experiments out of there on the homeless population and tuberculosis. And, you know, here comes Elisa Lam. I don't know. That was part of one of them. Then there is this that, okay. There was all these drugs and everything that were being tested for tuberculosis at this time. And like I said, the Center for Tuberculosis Research at the University of British Columbia, where Elisa went to school, and they published, some data about a drug which eliminated more than 99% of the bacteria within 2 weeks in an 85-person study. And, you know, blah, 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 blah. But the thing is that this New York-based nonprofit organization that did all this and funded all of it was supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
And see, and here we are in 2020, and what are we doing? The politicians all say that we're fighting the invisible enemy.
Yes.
And so here you have Elisa Lam's case that ties back to the Gates Foundation.
I know. And so, and, you know, it's just Bill Gates Foundation supported this one thing and all that. So, but it's just interesting. And I don't really understand necessarily the, okay. So this drug, I think it was called PAMZ. And the problem is that this PAMZ doesn't contain two main, I'm not even going to try and pronounce the ingredients, but doesn't contain the two main medicines used against tuberculosis. And quoting Business Week from 2012, researchers hope that it may provide a much needed weapon against certain things. And it was interesting that, you know, that came out. And then you had this tuberculosis, and apparently this tuberculosis was really, really bad because it was a resistant strain of it. I don't know.
And here in 2020, we have a resistant strain of.
Yes.
COVID. All of it just makes your head spin. It's like we know we're looking at something. We just don't know what we're looking at. But yeah, all of this stuff is the factual base because Inti and I read the article on it about the medical research.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So let's talk about this invisible light agency, and let's take it from both sides. This is one of the things I brought up in 2018, and it all started because when you use Google Maps and you zoom in to the Hotel Cecil, all of a sudden you see this company that's registered in the building, the Invisible Light Agency. And a lot of people say, well, there's no connection at all between the case and the Invisible Light Agency. So here's the thing. When you search it, you'll find that they do visual effects, special effects, and light effects, and other, you know, things like that. And the company apparently was created in about 2011. And, you know, what the activities of the Invisible Light Agency are. And one of the owners, or apparent owners, we're not sure, one of the apparent owners of it, and I'm not going to say their name, but was also working as a supervisor at Raytheon Missile Systems, a company that develops weapons. And they have a fake login screen on the website for Invisible Light Agency. And then there was this logo of the triangles. And the website does nothing. It serves nothing So the question is, say, what is this person supervising nowadays? What happened to the Invisible Light Agency?
Yeah. So I went kind of down that rabbit hole a little bit and looked at some of those people who I'm not going to name, but they do go on to transfer to several different defense companies and kind of carry on their path, so to speak.
Yeah. And here's the thing. Let's take the other part of it. Okay. I'll say, oh, you guys, you're making all this kind of stuff up kind of thing. And let's take that line. So one of the things is that, where the invisible, you know, light agency kind of continues with the conspiracy is that Elisa, like you said before, was murdered by a soldier, you know, outfitted with this kind of prototype invisibility cloak that she was talking about in a previous post, right? And that this soldier was sent to the Cecil to stalk and kill victims, maybe not necessarily in the Cecil, maybe just in the unhoused populations of downtown Los Angeles as an authorized kind of test of this technology.
I think it's weird that she was looking at the technology. She ended up talking to a soldier. She, on her Tumblr, is advertising she's coming to Los Angeles and exactly where she's going to and asking people if they want to meet up. Allegedly, that soldier reached out to her. And the whole thing with him goes on to be weirder because there's something going on with her Facebook later. But did she sign up for the game? And the reason I ask is because she goes on right before her California trip to talk about intelligent clothing, and she's posting all these model photos and stuff. And then when you look at her, she doesn't really dress like that. So I'm like, who is she trying to impress? Because, you know, her Twitter will say something like, you know, the more disposable income that I have, the more I dress like an English schoolboy. So what was with the whole intelligence thing? She posted things like, you know, I never knew how stupid people were until they opened their mouth. So she's constantly thinking she's above someone. This game, you know, to me does not seem out of the question that she would sign up to have someone hunt her through a hotel.
Yeah. I mean, that is, you know, a really, really good possibility. And the thing is that, okay, like you said, she retweeted that HuffPost article about the invisibility cloak, oh, by the way, which was made by a Canadian company.
Yeah, so the U.S. military is backing Canadian companies' development of material that renders soldiers invisible.
And so it's a real thing. Totally real. This is not.
At this time, that owner, right? This is important. That owner, he was posting, I need the military to recognize me. I need to do something to get, you know, on their mind, because he was trying to sell this stuff just so desperately. And he does go on to sell it. And I wonder if all of this, you know, is making sense, or if it sounds crazy to people. But what better way to show off your weapon and how well it works than to have it in a display like this?
And now, you know, to take the other side, you know, the Invisible Light Agency, a special effects company, which you could just say it's a company that closed. But when you go back and you look at who the owner was and where they also worked, you know, it's like almost like a front company, right? And some people say, well, it's just a company. It had invisible in their name.
Yeah, but it's a company that is a shell that is linked to Raytheon Company, which and goes on to acquire a ton of Howard Hughes old intelligence work with planes and things like that, if you want to go down that rabbit hole.
And one of the reasons that you can kind of get away with a lot of this stuff is that there have been, I believe, 15 deaths over the years, not just normal, hey, heart attack kind of things, but 15, like, crazy deaths in this hotel over the years. And so, you know, when you have something where it's, oh, she died or something like that, you know, people are used to crazy, crazy deaths in the hotel.
Yeah, and despite all of those mysteriously wild deaths, they don't go on to upgrade any of their camera systems.
I know. So here we go. So there was a guy who shot himself in the head in 1931, a guy who slit his own throat in 1934, 19-year-old Dorothy Jean Purcell threw her newborn child to its death from a window in 1944, later being declared not guilty by reason of insanity. Then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people all leaped or fell to their deaths in 1937, 38, 47, 54, and 62. In fact, 1962, there was two people who did it.
Not to interrupt you, I'm so sorry, but as you and I have covered these cases, as you gradually get into the 60s with the whole LSD and the experimenting and MK Ultra and all the kind of stuff that's hooked to that, we have had stories of people that went on to leap. I mean, famous kids, unfamous kids.
Yeah. And one woman jumped after an argument with her husband, fell nine stories, and landed on a 65-year-old person who happened to be walking by the hotel. Both were killed instantly. In 1964, a retired telephone operator, Pigeon Goldie Osgood, was stabbed, raped, and strangled to death in her room at the Cecil, a crime for which nobody was ever arrested. So you would also think, honestly, that this hotel would be a great place to play this game, because there's probably a whole lot of ghosts, probably a whole lot of dimensions and things going on. But, and also there were two serial killers who made it their residence, including Richard Ramirez. If Elisa Lam gets killed there by some kind of invisible cloaked warrior, hey, you just chalk it up to the Cecil. This is what happens at the Cecil. Strange things happen at the Cecil.
Yeah, just think about that. They pick a hotel where you say, yeah, things like that have happened before, no big deal. That can be shrugged off. You have the whole clouded thing with the Lam Elisa test. So you search for her death, and then that's clouded because you're getting TB tests instead. This stuff just seems all so slyly lined up to not amount to anything. And if you think about people jumping to their deaths and Elisa acting kind of crazy outside of an elevator, what would make you more psychologically shook than something bumping you, or you getting involved in something to where you can't see your enemy or what's coming at you? You know, she's motioning in the hallway as if she's, it almost looks like sign language, but it's not. I mean, who is she talking to? Was she trying to reason with them? Was she trying to plead with someone?
And was this person holding the door to keep it from closing? Because it doesn't close. And let's talk about for a second the people that, like, the second tape where Elisa walks into the hotel with two men.
Yeah, what is up with that? Where is that tape and why was it suppressed? You know, two men, well-dressed, walk into the lobby, and they hand her a white box. Now, if you go up and you look for white boxes in relation to the cloaking, okay, get back to me on that. That's crazy. So I question that whole scenario, but do you think that there was really two men?
I mean, I think so. But the problem is that
what
much
was in
like
the box?
Exactly. And, what was in the box? What are the two men coming? You know, there is apparently this tape that exists. And,
you have her, she's at a speakeasy, which I guess to her is maybe a bar, but she's someplace maybe she shouldn't be. And then suddenly she comes back to the hotel, surveillance catches her coming in, and then not shortly behind her, two men come in. They hand her a white box, and she disappears into the elevator with it. And that's kind of like the cut scene for that day. After she receives that box, her entire life is chaos.
Yeah. And apparently there's a third tape from the staircase of the 14th floor, which they to surveil the rooftop access. But that tape has never been released.
Right. And that info came from a security guard. I want to call him a bodyguard, but he's a bouncer that he was working the door at the time, say around 2015, 2016, and started poking around. He also said that allegedly the cameras that lined the fire escapes were all dummies in 2013, that they were just there as deterrents. They weren't capturing anything. He said that the hotel was so low on money. So when people say, you know, where's the rest of these tapes or whatever, I don't think there's a lot of cameras. I don't think that hotel was really into everything that went on there being captured on film.
No, because there was a lot of things going on in this hotel probably that, you know, they wanted to avoid prying eyes or the LAPD and things like that. You know, there was one of the things where so the staff, all of them had different stories. And I think that really kind of hurt the investigation, too. And then there was the maintenance staffer who had worked there for 3 or 4 years, a Mr. Santiago. And apparently he saw some things, and he was paid a large sum of money to leave Los Angeles for Mexico and not return. And he did.
Yeah, that guy took off. His family didn't even know that he was leaving until after he was gone. And then allegedly he told his brother a little bit of the story. But he's the maintenance worker that goes on to find Elisa Lam floating in the tank face up, which face up is odd for drowning victims anyways. And there was no water in her lungs. But anyways, he went on to say in the court transcripts that the hatch was open. But LAPD and fire had always said that the lid was closed. And yeah. If that girl, as petite as she is, had climbed into that tank, there's no way that she'd have been able to close that lid on top of herself.
No, and you know, this was my whole thing when we did it the first time, is that she was tiny. You know, look at the pictures of the water tanks, okay? They look complicated and hard to get into in the middle of the day. To try and do that at night, in the dark, seems improbable, if not impossible. It seems improbable, if not impossible, to lift it up and then to pull it back down, you know? And here's the only way to really get there, other than, I guess, through this 14th story stairwell, is I guess you could do the fire escape. And the fire escape is interesting because there was a report, I think last year on HLN, they did an interview with a detective who said, because the LAPD originally had said that the dogs didn't get a scent at all in her room of where she went. And the detective said that's not true, that they did get a scent to the fire escape. But then they didn't get any other scents. The dog couldn't find any others outside on the fire escape.
You know, my opinion of that, and you're exactly right, is they said that the dogs had picked up on a window and then the second place that you mentioned. But if her feet, you know, the dogs didn't smell the fact that she went up the ladder, then she probably didn't climb that ladder by herself. You know, I think probably someone carried her. And the reason is because I comb over her autopsy from time to time because this case fascinates me. And the pebbles that they found in the tank, obviously they don't belong there. It's drinking water, but they match what you would walk on, you know, right before you got to the ladder. So to me, it's like her clothes were taken off, you know, and then kind of maybe wrapped up on the ground, and they got all the pebbles and stuff in them. And then as someone went to throw the clothes in, you know, that stuff goes in also. I don't think that the girl, if she was wearing her clothes, was rolling around on the ground prior to getting the tank. That seems weird, right?
Yeah, it does. And you know, things that we've talked about before, like you said, you know, the majority of drowning victims are found face down in the water, with water in the lungs and stomach. She'd had none of that. She was face up. And, you know,
and the maintenance worker said, I looked in and I saw something that I knew was not correct. And it was that the water was red. Okay, well, if she had no traumatic injuries per the medical examiner and no trauma, nothing that would lead her to believe that this investigation is a result of foul play, where was the blood coming from? Well, I mean, it was coming from her bottom. And, I mean, what would cause that? There's only two things. If you overdose, you could bleed out of your eyes, your nose, and your bottom, which they didn't find anything in toxicology that states that she would be ODing, or rape.
Now, and the rape, you know, there was a problem with the rape kits and everything like that. Because I think that the coroner said, you know, they took multiple swabs but they had said, oh, it didn't appear that she was sexually assaulted, but nobody knows where that rape kit is anymore.
Oh yeah, and the rape kit is supposedly missing, and the coroner never addresses what is going on with her backside. Like, why would she be bleeding from there out of all places? I mean, if she fell into the tank and hit her head, we'd go, okay, well, trauma from hitting her head. But I mean, that's an odd place for her to be bleeding from. And then the coroner not address it at all and then chalk it up as no foul play.
Well, and the coroner took 6 months to declare the cause of death, right? I mean, and then went back and crossed out her conclusion, which, you know, it's that kind of thing where, okay, you're just making it worse for everybody because you can't even decide, you know?
Yeah. And so they have it as cause of death, drowning, manner of death, accidental, and then underlying cause bipolar disorder. But this girl, she had been public for so long. I mean, maybe even years. She had written all about her bipolar and how she struggled and stuff. To me, she's the perfect candidate to set up, you know, for something like this, because you could just chalk it off as, you know, she's crazy. And then what I wanted to ask you is that you have a Chinese national and she has been going to school for a long time, even though she didn't complete a ton of classes. She is educated. You can tell from her writing. Why would somebody like that tell their family, I'm going to pick up, I'm going to move to Santa Cruz, and I'm going to start working on possibly an organic food farm?
Yeah, you know.
Is that a blanketed excuse? Do we think?
Well,
that
I mean, she
really
did do the normal tourist thing. She took a train all the way down to San Diego. You know, she did start in San Diego, and she apparently everything was fine down there. Then she comes up to L.A. and, you know, starts having problems. And in the first, you know, episode of it, we talked about how she had a shared room, and the two people, I guess, in the room thought that she was acting odd, and so then they ended up putting her in a solo room. So I do wonder, you know, I don't know if they ever interviewed, if the police ever interviewed those two people or not.
I think that's probably where they got their story from, but I don't think those people were wrong, and this might lead us to believe that she might have been a little off of her meds and stuff, is because right before she disappeared, her last public appearance where she spoke to people was at the Last bookstore. And it's by the Cecil, and Katie Orphan said she spoke to her, and she was very lively and outgoing. Another male business person spoke to her, and he said she was very peculiar, and he was ready to get away from her because she was too open and talking about stuff that you wouldn't normally talk about with strangers. So, you know,
I mean, that could have been a manic episode, and what happened in the elevator could have been a manic episode. But it doesn't take away from the fact that bipolar manic episode, I still have no idea how she would ever manage to even think, okay, well, I'm going to go to the roof. And, you know, every death that I read off of there, for the vast majority of them, they just jumped out of a window, jumped off the top of the building, jumped off their fire escape. You know, so if she wanted to kill herself, there was much easier ways than the way that she chose.
And, oh, definitely. And when you talk about going to a hotel roof, as we've seen in other cases, you talked about the Soho House and stuff like that, how somebody was able to, you know, hook up with a worker, go off, do drugs and stuff like that. Usually when you're talked into doing stupid stuff like that, it's because a worker's involved. So you could see like a maintenance worker or staff or somebody saying, hey, let's go to the roof. You know, because it's their idea. They're used to the facility. They work there all the time. So they know that the roof is private and they know how to get there. She likely didn't know that her card key could open those doors that maybe were or weren't locked. It's always debatable if the fire escapes were even locked.
I am going to tell you something that will blow your mind. And it's not going to solve it. I'm going to the farthest out of conspiracies to kind of say, going back to the elevator game a little bit. And this is a little bit odd.
That's
but,
okay. I love crazy. Let's go.
There is Aleister Crowley. And this guy was born Edward Alexander Crowley. He's also known as the Great B666. He was a British occultist, a mystic, a ceremonial, a magician kind of thing. He founded the religious philosophy of Thelema. And one of the things, according to Thelemic legend, in 1918... Aleister Crowley came into contact with an interdimensional entity named Lam. L-A-M.
Oh my gosh, where is my Excedrin? This is also crazy.
who, by the way, is a dead ringer for the popular conception of the alien gray depicted on the cover of Whitley Strieber's Communion. From this purported encounter, some have inferred that the industrious Mr. Crowley intentionally opened a portal of entry through the practice of magic ritual and the Amalantra working, which allowed the likes of Lam and other alien greys a passageway onto the earth plane. Further, this portal may have been further enlarged by Parsons and Hubbard in 1946 with the commencement of the Babylon working, thus facilitating a monumental paradigm shift in human consciousness, sex, and rockets. I think that's probably a stretch.
That's a lot. I mean, unless she was in her room with a bunch of candles and she had social media stuff that kind of aligned to that line of thinking and stuff. I mean, I can't even go there unless you bring in, like, I don't know, this is some crazy cabal and the whole entire thing's a setup. You know, she's dressed like the girl from Dark Water, and the girl's name in the movie is Cecilia, and this girl dies at the Cecil. I mean, to bring all that in, then you would have to say it really is really Hollywood scripted.
Well, I know, and there's all kinds of other ones. You know, people take the 14 and they say, okay, well, that's the 14th book of the Bible, and then they read the 10, the 7, the 4 or whatever, and they read the verses that go with that. And then that leads them to, you know, Elise is a biblical name, Lamb as in Lamb of God kind of thing. And then they talk about how, you know, I am seal is an anagram for Elisa Lamb. And, you know, in Revelations, there's when he broke the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth animal shout, come immediately after another horse appeared, and just kind of things. So, I mean, it's just, oh my gosh, there's so many places.
And then you got the
go.
Numerological people that are all about the number four, and the fact that four, you know, to most Asian culture is considered, I guess, a bad number. You guys see that written a lot in the fourth floor. I guess she stayed on the fourth floor. I don't know. Something happened on the fourth floor, and everything adds up to fours. So that's out there.
I know. And it just because her name is so you can move so many things around, and she's got some really good name, like letters to make other words. You know, it just it leads to that kind of thing. But I did think that the Aleister Crowley, where it was LAM, was kind of interesting because of the fact that it was talking about portals, and then other people had been talking about the elevator games.
It just makes you wonder if this girl was sought out because of her name. Did somebody sit down and type in Elisa Lamb, or just look at people that had Lamb in their name and try to find someone that was the most vulnerable and someone they could go after? Because everything, firstly, aligns to her name. You know, the other symbolism is kind of secondary, but the name, it just seems very important.
So in all of this, all of these conspiracies, all of these thoughts, when we first did this back in September 2018, has anything changed your thoughts of who did it? Or not even who, but because I don't even think I came up with a who, I just came up with a... I think I actually did come up with a who. But anyway,
did we? I didn't go back and listen, so I don't know if we said who.
I came up with, I believe, and I did not go back and listen either, but now because I've always been with the employee. So my thing was, I think you could narrow it down to an assistant manager or manager. The person I believe that I said that moved Elisa from the shared room to the solo room, because it has to be somebody who has access to making key cards, because somebody had entered her room before. It has to be somebody who had access to get up on the roof. It has to be, you know, somebody who can maybe down in the lobby hold the elevator so it doesn't move anywhere. So it has to be, you know, it could be a housekeeper or somebody like that who had a card, but they wouldn't really have a reason. So it could be a maintenance person. So I said either, but the maintenance person wouldn't necessarily be able to do other things. So I said, you know, the police needed to look, I think, at an assistant manager or manager as the person. And, you know, I don't think that that's changed. Now, it doesn't mean that the assistant manager or manager wasn't involved in something more nefarious or something, and that Elisa needed to be disposed of, rather than Elisa being, you know, sexually assaulted or something like that. My guess is that somebody took Elisa Lamb up to the roof, raped her, and then dumped her in the thing.
That's interesting. Yeah, I do think that we decided that we thought it was a hotel employee to begin with. I'm not so sure now. I think they might have helped cover it up because of the finance deal and stuff like that. I still think it's a murder. I just think there was a lot more going on in that hotel. Yeah, and that she got involved in something that she might have overplayed her hand in. Perhaps they scared her to death, and then they needed to get rid of her.
Yeah, because, you know, maybe she found something and they realized, okay, this person, she's a little bit manic. She's a little bit off. It's just going to be easier if we kill her. And
yeah, because, I mean, it must have been someone that she came in contact with at some point. They were worried about what type of surveillance or whatever she had on her, because her cell phone goes missing. Her laptop goes missing. You know, LAPD doesn't talk about pinging it or trying to find any of that stuff. That her card key was found in the tank. So they basically just take her electronics off of her and they take her glasses away. So this is all about somebody who doesn't want to be seen. They don't want whatever went on in that hotel to escape. I totally think management's in on it.
Well, they are in it because somebody had to screw with the tape, which is why I think when we originally did this, I eliminated the maintenance people. Because the maintenance people obviously would have a card to get into the rooms and up onto the roof, but they wouldn't have the ability to change or edit the security camera footage. They wouldn't have... You know, so that's why so let's say she was murdered And whether or not an assistant manager or manager did it, they helped cover it up.
Definitely, because, you know, one of the weird things is that when in talking to the security guard, just randomly, the Cecil, he says, has a trap door in the boiler room. Like, you open it and it goes to an underground tunnel system that connects the two hotels. I don't know if he means it just connects the Cecil and the Stay at Main or whatever, but I mean, that's definitely some place where if you worked at a hotel, you could hide a body for a little while and perhaps the dogs or police or whatever would not detect it down there. And then possibly she was moved to the tank because she was in the water for quite a while. She had mold growing on her. So she was moved not too long after.
If the top was up on the water tower, on the thing, I think that if the dogs had gone up there, they would have smelled it.
Yeah, I do too. If she had been in there, you know, at the time that they searched with the dogs and her body was actually in there, you would think they'd hit on something like that. Because, I mean, if it was coming out of the taps and the residents were getting a taste of it, the dogs, they have keen sense of smell. They would have got a whiff of it.
Yeah, I think something that Janet said before was, if you can you imagine waking up in the night, not turning on the lights and just going to get your tap and, you know, putting in the glass and then taking a sip of that? That would be.
Yeah. Imagine horrific. You're a longtime resident because some people had lived there for years, decades.
Yeah. Because they just have regular like residential units and then they had ones that they would rent by the night. And I mean.
So they just get up out of bed and they go take a swig and oh gosh.
Straight up decomposition there. So we're in agreement, murdered. We don't know exactly by who, but we agree that management helped cover it up.
That's my synopsis here.
I think so. I mean,
I love that we're on the same page. I don't know. This just fascinates me. It's one of my definitely top five weirdest cases.
It is. And, you know, I enjoy that there are so many, you know, roads to go down. And you know, the reason that there are so many roads to go down is because it's because of the video. It just fascinates people and it makes people want to speculate about what happened and keeps people interested and keeps people coming back. And, you know, maybe eventually there will be some kind of answers or maybe another video will be released or, you know, because it definitely keeps the pressure on and it definitely gets people, you know, digging more and more and more. And it's all because of that video.
Yeah, it's very reminiscent of the Kaninka Jenkins case that you and I had talked about also back in 2018.
Yes, exactly. Well, it was great going back to episode 9, the first time that we recorded together, and it all came back as we were talking about it, what I was thinking and at that time, and it was fascinating then, it's fascinating now, and to have the blog ping that person in just in the last week is crazy. So, you know, I imagine we'll get back at it again in 2022 and see where it's at then.
Definitely.
So have a great weekend and be safe, and everybody out there be safe too.
Thank you. Yes, everyone have a good weekend. Bye.
Bye.